This is The Conversation on Hawaii Public Radio. I'm Catherine Cruz. Two homeless men died on the streets of Honolulu in the last few weeks. Police are investigating the stabbing cases, but it underscores the dangers to those without shelter. Many cases are believed to be linked to mental illness, and the city, along with the Institute for Human Services, is working to try and solve chronic homelessness with a move toward court-ordered mental health treatment. Mark Alexander is the director of the city's Office of Housing, and Rebecca Soon is the deputy of the Community Services Department. They sat down with us recently to talk about the latest outreach navigation program.
Well, I think the main thing is this is a part of the puzzle. You know, we always try to take a systems approach. We're not trying to look at any program in isolation. So we acknowledge this as another tool in the tool chest. And we know that there are people who are suffering from severe mental illness and those who are suffering from substance use disorder, chronically homeless. And so the way this works is basically we're saying to a provider, you have the specialized skills and resources to specifically target this population. First of all, to try to persuade them to receive services that they need to move them to better health. And if that doesn't work, you know, gradually, it's called progressive engagement, engage them at a higher level. Could be guardianship, could be the assisted community treatment law, but try to get them the help that they need and create a plan, because part of this proposal, part of this program, is that they create really a health plan, a plan to get people to a better place. And so what we're doing is we're providing the resources that the providers have said, hey, we need more street psychiatry. We need to get the advanced practice registered nurses that have specialty in psychiatry on the street. We need to have lawyers that can help guide people through the process when that's necessary so that we can take advantage of the changes in the assisted community treatment law. And all of it's designed to help people who really need help.
And, you know, we've seen the stories where the life expectancy of someone out on the street is not long. I mean, in their 50s. Mm-hmm. You know, talk about that.
Yeah, so I think Mayor talked about how someone living on the street is likely to live decades shorter than someone who is in a housed situation. And I think as an average of possibly 53 years. I mean, that's devastating. I mean, we're talking about people who could be our mothers, our sisters, our brothers. And in every single situation, there's sort of a unique set of circumstances that brought them to where they are. You know, we talk about the humanity and the compassion of what it means to sort of reach individuals who are really suffering with things that are beyond what many of us understand. And so what we try to do is make sure that at the city, we're working with our partners. As Mark mentioned, you know, we really do understand the unique expertise that our service providers have. And each one of them have been working with unique populations for decades. So whether it's individuals suffering with a mental illness, individuals suffering with substance abuse, developmental disabilities, they really have developed these unique capabilities to understand how those individuals can thrive. And so we really see it as our role to be a partner in that and just help empower the resources and the tools that they need to be able to better serve those populations, better serve those communities, and really meet clients where they are.
So, Mark, explain, how do we start rolling this out? You know, you've teamed up with IHS.
Sure. IHS actually has already begun to roll it out. They have a short list of clients that they want to target and reach out because they've been doing something similar to this for a while already, so they have expertise. And so they're going to go after that client list with special outreach efforts, with assertive case management and outreach to try to touch these clients and persuade them to receive services, and then just go through the process. You know, if that doesn't work, then they'll go to the next step. If they can connect with someone, you know, who's family or go through formal guardianship, they'll do that. And if that doesn't work, then they'll move to the next level. And so I think that's what we really want to see happen, is them actually getting out and working that list. See, one of the things we've learned, we have this thing called coordinated entry system now in place so that we try to assess anyone who's homeless, kind of prioritize them, and then match them with really restricted limited resources so that the people that are most vulnerable get the help that they need. So, but what we do is we look at people by name. It's not just a number, it's by name. So we know them. And so I think this is what IHS is doing. They know these clients by name. And they will also ask other providers in different areas the names of clients that they think fit in this category of someone who really needs help who can't help themselves.
And then what are the legal concerns that folks might have, whether it's a group like the ACLU? How do we address the worries that we're going to infringe on somebody's civil rights?
So I think that the Assisted Community Treatment Act, which is in Hawaii revised statutes, has set up provisions to make sure that an individual's due process rights, or their personal liberty and privacy rights, are being treated appropriately and are not being infringed upon. And so ultimately, the law really does provide parameters around how to make sure that, for example, if the IHS caseworker and nurse who goes out and says, okay, we're going to just have an initial engagement. How are you doing? What's going on? Try to get to know and understand the unique needs of this person. Once they get flagged to a point where it looks like, you know, there is really some need here for some additional psychiatric support, then they'll bring in psychiatric support, bring in registered nurses, bring in people who are trained to be able to assess the medical side of the needs of that individual. As Mark mentioned, also bring in an attorney to say, in IHS's perspective, is this going to be a situation where this person really does need to have intervention of the law? If that's avoidable, if the person either chooses on their own to take care or chooses to allow us to work with a family member, and oftentimes, many times, our family members, right, who are involved. Guardians have the ability to go to the court and be established as having some ability to have legal rights to help ensure care for their family member who really just can't make those decisions on their own. So as we're really talking about a much narrower set of times where it's going to be a attorney and a psychiatrist on behalf of IHS putting in a petition with the court to then say, you know, this person, this individual, we've done this assessment, we've gone through the steps, and we believe that they really are needing some intervention by the legal system. And then it's really up to a judge to take a look at the totality of the picture. The individual will be able to have a public defender representing them as well, especially if they're saying something other than what's being recommended. And so the entire process is really meant to try to protect the individual. Of course, I think everyone is concerned about any time that we're doing something that appears to be involuntary. You know, anyone is going to have concerns about how do we protect that individual. So the law has been crafted and created in a way that ensures that. And again, it's going to hopefully be a small number of cases.
Yeah. You know, it's kind of like a five-step process too. You know, people immediately think, oh, we're going to jump right to involuntary commitment. No, not at all. I mean, the first step is that kind of targeted outreach. Second step is really to assess and evaluate the clients that one encounters. The third step is to, you know, work with the medical professionals, especially those with psychiatric specialization, to come up with a treatment plan, a case management plan for that person. And then you work with the medical practitioners to actually implement that plan. And if the client will not voluntarily accept that, then you look at things like decisional capacity. You look at utilizing things like the assisted community treatment program. And then the final thing I think that we want to keep in mind throughout this whole thing is that we're going to create partnerships all along the way. This isn't just about IHS working, you know, with its one psychiatrist and APRN or its attorney. It's about working within a system, working with the Department of Health and their collaborators that focus on, you know, adult mental health, for example.
APRN is what?
I'm sorry, Advanced Practice Registered Nurse. So that's one of the things. One of the things we did with this RFP is we had someone who actually specializes in this field help review it and give us input. So you know, wanted to make sure it's kind of to hoil.
You talked about how IHS already knows who's out there on the street. And the other day I was driving down by the viaduct, and I used to do a lot of stories about the homeless there. Now you've got Duane Carice's little homeless village, Kawiki Village. There were a number of folks that I knew down under the viaduct. They've got heavy equipment. They're doing construction work. And I had to just stop and think, gosh, I wonder where these folks went. Mm-hmm. You know, because after a while, you do get to know who's living under the bridge, and you worry about them because it's not safe. There was one gal who I did interview, and she was bitten, I think, by the same dog that the police were investigating. There was one homeless man who died in the stream, and mm-hmm. he was attacked by dogs, but they didn't know which dog did it. They didn't mm-hmm. have video. Mm-hmm. But just the dangers of living out there on the streets.
It's really appalling. I mean, that's why I think when the medical examiner, Dr. Happy, took the time to go through the records, you know, for 5 years, and last year, 2018, was the deadliest year for homeless persons. 90 people died on the streets for various reasons. But, you know, as Becky was saying, I mean, when you're dying, and Mayor emphasized this, when the average age is less than 53 on the streets, we're going like, hey, wait a second, this is a wake-up call. And we know a common nexus is with mental illness. I mean, I think Connie was very specific. Connie Mitchell, ED of IHS, was very explicit yesterday when she said, look, you see someone sitting in their poop and pee, you've got a problem. And, you know, maggots coming out of wounds. I mean, this person really needs help. Mm-hmm. I mean, I remember years ago, you know, Governor Abercrombie at the time saying, you know, and he's one very concerned about people's civil liberties, as we all are. But, you know, even he said, this isn't right. I think our compassion, you know, can't just be words. It has to be actions. And, you know, we're able to do this. And again, I think sometimes people forget really pushing the edge of what we can do as city and county. Mm-hmm. Health is the purview of the federal government and the state government. It's not in our charter, but we're pushing as hard as we can because this is so important. And, you know, I think Mayor made that very clear. Mayor Caldwell made that clear as our entire team. That's why we showed up saying, hey, this is really critical. And we're excited that we're finally at a stage where we can implement this program.
So Honolulu's doing this. What about the neighbor islands? Anything similar to this out there?
Not that I know of, maybe Mark would know, but I know that Adult Mental Health Division, they have had an intensive case management program for a couple of years now. And so they've been able to see the need in that really spending more time with individuals who are suffering from mental illness on the street gains rapport, gains trust, and it ultimately helps to connect them back to that network that Mark was talking about. There are existing tools to try to hook people into. Our ultimate goal is always to try to get people into housing because we know that from there they can stabilize their lives and they can have wraparound services that ensure that they can have, you know, a healthier focus on other things as well, right? And so we're always trying to connect folks, whether it's to housing or whether it's to mental health treatment, whether it's to clean and sober treatment, which oftentimes happens at the same time, right? Oftentimes people on the street are really dealing with their own mental illness or physical illnesses as well by self-medicating through drugs and alcohol. And so trying to connect folks, though, to those services, because when you're on the street and even for someone who, frankly, isn't dealing with the level of mental illness that we're talking about today, it is a traumatic space to be in, and it is a survival mode. Mm-hmm. And so just working with families and individuals to help shift mentality away from survivalism and into healthy, thriving lives is really critical.
I'll add the state, when they did make the changes to ACT, the Assisted Community Treatment Law, they did also fund $100,000 to help support the implementation of that. So the state does have a small pot of money that they could utilize, for example, on the neighbor islands or in concert perhaps with our programming.
Are there required reporting points?
It's a one-year contract for $500,000, but the mayor has funded it for 2 years. So there'll be additional funding should this program work, should the process and the outreach work, we'll be able to add additional funds or put out an additional contract. So under that one-year contract, their goal is to do outreach to 100 mentally ill individuals. So 100 of the folks that we're really talking about focusing on, the highest acuity, highest need individuals. And from there, the goal is to have at least 40 of them be going through the process to try to get onto medication. And so again, that could be any of the different approaches that Mark talked about earlier. So
if any of our listeners are out there and let's say they know somebody in their neighborhood, mm-hmm. is there a way that they can wave their hand and say, hey, I think I've got someone here who could benefit?
Sure. I mean, I think they can always let us know, mm-hmm. and then we can let IHS know. I don't want to speak for IHS and say, please go ahead and call IHS. I don't want to do that. But no, the engagement of the public actually is really important mm-hmm. and very helpful. So we encourage that. You can make a phone call, you know, to our homeless helpline, to the state homeless helpline. Our general number is 768-4675. They can also use our new 311 app, which allows you to report homeless concerns. Sometimes and you can do it anonymously. You know, again, the idea is we just want to get the accurate information and be able to try to help people. And even if they're not a proper candidate for this specific program, we will send outreach. We will make sure that there is some kind of endeavor to offer that person, you know, services.
Right. So they're on somebody's radar.
Yes.
That's right.
The main thing I want to underscore is that compassion requires action, and it requires all of us working together. Simply not helping people who are hard to help or complicated doesn't give us permission not to try something new. And I think this is kind of an innovative program. We couldn't find a real model for it. And so that's why, you know, I applaud, you know, Mayor Caldwell and the City Council for supporting this. And, you know, as we said, it's a proof of concept, but we're ready to go with year two already because we really believe that this is something that we need and will deliver results that really make a difference in the lives of people and even save lives.
That was the city's homeless coordinator, Director of Housing Mark Alexander, and Rebecca Soon, the Deputy Director of the Community Services Department. They were talking about the latest outreach to help the mentally ill living on Honolulu streets.
I'm Jonathan Parrish, Executive Director of the Hawaii Symphony Orchestra. Yeah, the obvious connection is classical music, but the Hawaii Public Radio audience is obviously an audience that likes to be informed and likes to be entertained, and we think that's our audience too. It's great to be able to support such a worthwhile service while getting the word out about what we do.
Hawaii Public Radio Underwriting, your message heard here. Learn more at hawaiipublicradio.org.
On the next Fresh Air, breaking the Harvey Weinstein story, we talk with New York Times reporters Jody Cantor and Megan Toohey. In their new book, She Said, they write about their investigation and the people and practices that protected Weinstein. They also reveal new details about what Harvey's brother and business partner, Bob, knew about Harvey's behavior. Join us.
This afternoon at 3, following On Point.
This is The Conversation on statewide member-supported Hawaii Public Radio. Coming up, your backyard quiz. In today's backyard quiz, we're trekking over to the Mo'omomi Preserve, located on the northwestern coast of Molokai. Created in 1988, the preserve is seen as one of the last intact beaches and sand dune areas in the state. It is managed by the Nature Conservancy in partnership with the State Department of Land and Natural Resources. It's also home to more than 22 native Hawaiian plant species, including 4 that are considered rare or endangered. One such species is believed to be only found at Mo'omomi. The plant is a member of the sunflower family and thrives in dry coastal shrublands on solidified chalky sand dunes. In Hawaii, the flower is most commonly threatened by deer, cattle, alien insects, alien plants, and even off-road vehicles. For our quiz, can you tell us the common name for Tetramelopium rockii? Call 941-3689 or 877-941-3689 if you think you know the answer. The first one to get it right gets a reusable tote bag that tells people you got it right.
Aloha, I'm Ellie Carvalho from the University of Hawaii at Manoa School of Communications. You're listening to The Conversation on member-supported Hawaii Public Radio.
Hula for Health. A new study out heralds the results that hip swaying, Ami and slide can do wonders for your heart. That's the subject of today's reality check. Honolulu Civil Beat reporter Eleni Gill on the line today. Good morning.
Aloha kakahiaka. Hi.
So now, do you know how to dance hula?
Yeah, actually, I've danced hula since I was like 5 years old, I think, with halau hula olehua o nana'i hale in Papakolea, and my kumu Lehua Matsuoka is from Lana'i.
Well, I think it's just terrific that this study, which started years ago, is really getting high marks.
Yeah, so this project, it's called the Kaholo Project, which is named after the most famous vamp step in hula. It started 10 years ago, but back then it was more of a look at how hula could be used in recovery for health. What I recently wrote about is the culmination of 800 hula classes over 5 years, and the University of Hawaii's medical school, they have a Department of Native Hawaiian Health, and they wanted to take a look at how hula can actually be used as a prevention for cardiovascular disease, especially among Native Hawaiians.
Yeah, I mean, it really is remarkable that folks have been able to manage their high blood pressure and just overall health.
Yeah, what they found actually is that of the folks, so most of them were women. I believe it was 88 or more than 80% were women. And the average age was 58 years old. And on average, they were able to reduce their blood pressure to a more healthy rate. And this is a particularly significant finding because Native Hawaiians are, in general, 4 times more likely to experience heart disease and stroke than non-Hispanic white patients. And also, Hawaiians tend to develop cardiovascular diseases an average of maybe, you know, a decade earlier than Hawaii's Asian and white populations. So it was pretty exciting to see how, you know, for the first time, I think this is the first time hula was used as a health intervention and subjected to a scientific study through a clinical trial. And it was supported with funding by the National Institutes of Health.
And the study looked at different islands, not just Oahu, right?
Right, correct. So there were many different health centers and hula halau that participated and partnered in this Kaholo project. On Oahu, it was Waianae Coast Comprehensive Health Center, Iola Lahui, Ke Ola Mamo, Kula Nona, Po'e Hawaii, and those were on Oahu. On Maui, Hui no Ke Ola Pono Clinic Health Center, and then Maui Ola on the Big Isle. So it was pretty amazing how they were able to incorporate hula as an intervention for managing blood pressure into that community setting at local health clinics.
And I imagine, you know, just besides getting up and moving around, that just being in that setting, the camaraderie of your hula sisters or brothers really helps to kind of calm you down.
Yeah, totally. Well, if you've never danced hula before, it's kind of easy to overlook its physicality. And they actually, so the study, they looked at the national guidelines for what accounts for a real physical activity, and they measured the rate of energy the dancers were expending when dancing hula. And they found that hula got a MET level of 7, and that means a metabolic equivalent, comparable actually to a pickup basketball game or tennis. So first of all, it's, you know, it's obvious hula is a really great exercise, but the study also goes to show, like what you were saying, is having that cultural connection and having that camaraderie was a really important factor in helping the participants want to keep going to hula class. I think one of the participants, Arma Oana, was saying that she and her hula sisters are all sort of fighting the same battles when it came to their health. So having that hula ohana, as well as like the opportunity to connect with their culture, really made a difference. And as they saw the results, as they were losing weight and they were seeing improvement in their blood sugar control, it was, you know, really wonderful experience for them.
Yeah, and I imagine that the participants really stick with the program because they have those ties, the relationships.
Yeah, mm-hmm, definitely. The retention rate after 6 months, I think they had 87% of the folks still participating, and after a year, 77%. And so the lead author and principal investigator of the study, Dr. Keawe Aimoku Koholokula, said those types of retention rates are unheard of in clinical trials. So I think this model can definitely be used across the nation, and so they want to look at it more. And I think it's getting more on the national radar, you know, the benefits of a program like this.
Yeah, well, I think it's amazing that it can be just as strenuous as basketball or tennis.
Yeah.
But yeah, so Hanahohula, thanks so much, Eleni.
Mahalo for having me.
All right, that was health reporter Eleni Gill with today's reality check. To read her full story, visit civilbeat.org.
I'm Rachel Schutz from Artists for Social Justice. Hear the conversation live or anytime you want on the HPR mobile app. Find it in the Apple App Store or on Google Play.
Sunflowers aren't native to Hawaii, but the bright, cheery flowers have been a boost to Hawaii's export seed industry. We recently talked to Corteva Agrisciences' Alika Napier and Christine Alexander, the principal of Wailua High School, who saw a sunflower windfall of $50,000 this summer as the company marked its 20th anniversary on Oahu's North Shore. Sunflowers were an experiment to fill the void when sugar plantations shut down on Oahu. I recall going out in the fields in the early days when Pacific Biodiesel experimented with it as a crop. But it's now in full production as an export seed crop, and Corteva's Wailua Plant Seed Company is reaping the benefits along with its community partners.
So Corteva Agriscience was previously known as Dow DuPont. Our site in particular was Pioneer Hybrid International that started back in Wailua in 1999. So this year marked our 20th anniversary. We typically grow the sunflowers in the November timeframe, but due to the hurricanes or the threats of hurricanes last year, it got pushed back, and we figured it would coincide perfectly with our 20th anniversary in July. So that's why we moved it to July. But we've been growing sunflowers for the past 15 years. The sunflowers are part of a project. It's a quality control project in which we have a representative sample of the varieties that we have for sale. And so we grow it out so that we can take a look at it to make sure that they're uniform in plant architecture, size, height, etc. They have the physical characteristics that we say that they're going to have. And the only way to do that is to physically grow them out and look at them. And so that's what we've been doing for the past 15 years in Wailua. The project that you're talking about with Pacific Biodiesel is separate. They had borrowed some land of ours to do some testing to see what types of crops would be good for their project in creating biodiesel. And this was probably 10 years ago or something like that, yes.
I remember they were having quite a time because the birds were eating the sunflower seeds.
That's something that does happen. You know, once the flowers mature, seeds come on, and then the birds are the next thing to attack them.
Yeah, they call it the bird tax,
yes.
I think. So we grow the sunflowers for oil?
Yes.
Is that how we were experimenting with it?
It's all for cooking oil. It's actually not an experiment. It's a production. So what that is, it's a predominantly the European countries utilize it for cooking oil. Not so much in the United States yet, but a big market is in the European countries. So a lot of this product will be exported to that locations throughout the world. They like the cooking oil because it doesn't impart a lot of flavor to the food. So thereby, they're able to utilize their spices or their cooking techniques and have the flavor come through with the sunflower oil, and you can cook at a higher heat.
Gotcha. Gee, I did not know that we were exporting that.
It's actually the seed that is being exported.
Okay.
Yes.
Okay. All right. That makes better sense. Okay. Yes. So explain how then it turned out to be just this wonderful plus for Wailua Schools.
Well, throughout the years, lots of people have been coming to visit the sunflowers prior to social media, which I find intriguing. They would have their own little following. Somehow, someone created a Facebook page for the Wailua Sunflowers, and you'd have 40 to 50 people trespassing, essentially, coming to the farm and trying to take photos and various activities. We let the activities remain unknown. So these activities would occur in the fields, and we said, wow, they would be in rotation amongst our other crops in the farm. And you'd have people, and you're trying to get work done. At the same time, you have people running through and frolicking around. And so we decided, well, this is very difficult for us to manage. So let's bring the fields back behind our farm in the back portion of our plant where it's somewhat more controlled and is a little more secure. And if we opened it up to the public for a period of a few hours a day, because we still have to get our normal activities done, and see what happens. The first year we had about 8,000 people.
Whoa.
And that was, I want to say it was 2016 that we did it. And since they came, and there's a lot of people that had come, we said, wow, if we were to partner with the local nonprofits in the area, and they would take just a $5 fee, they can come to see the sunflowers for free and walk around, whatever. But for the parking, if we have a nonprofit organization man that, and see what happens. And throughout the years, we partnered with partners within the Wailua community. It was the Bull Pups, sports activities, Wailua Elementary School, and then this year it was with the Wailua High School. And we also did a partnership with the Wailua Waihoa Rotary Club and a event with the Wailua Elementary as well. But predominantly, the majority of the days of the event was in benefit of the Wailua High School.
Okay, and so Christine Alexander, then this turned out to be a wonderful surprise for you, right?
It sure did, yes.
The day after school ended for the school year.
Correct. Yes, Alika came to see me the day after school ended to let us know that they were going to be looking at doing the sunflowers in July, and would we like to participate and help out.
And so how did that come together?
Well, Corteva has been part of our community for a few years now. They do participate in our school community council. We've always had a representative, which used to be DuPont Pioneer, join us on our monthly meeting times. And so we've developed a relationship and a bond with them over the last few years. And so when they approached us and asked us, would we be interested in helping out with this particular event, we immediately rose to the occasion, unbeknownst to us how much funds were going to come in.
So it was a real windfall for you folks this year.
Most definitely it was, yes. We did have the added burden of school being finished, so we did send an email out to as many as we could to encourage them to join us, and we were fortunate to have the softball team, JROTC join us, and also the student body government students.
So you had enough hands on deck to help with the parking and
yes,
all of
lucky
that.
For us, it was summer, and that meant a little slower in the office as well. So our office staff joined us. Many coaches came out to help, and we were really fortunate. Administration, so we were very fortunate, yes.
So it was a generous gift, and so what are you going to do with all that money?
Well, we raised much more money than we anticipated. Our goal was to raise enough money to purchase a digital marquee, mainly because one of the things we're focusing on is communication with the community. And so we really feel it's important to have something that we could share with the community on events and different activities that are happening at the school. So we did raise, we reached our goal, and we're also going to share that money with those that came out to support us. So the softball team will be receiving some funds, and JROTC and student body government.
Okay, so when does the community get to see your new marquee?
Well, it is in production. We did purchase it already, and they are keeping tabs on us. It is coming in from the mainland. So it is in production. It's expected to be finished in October, November timeframe. And then, of course, we have to do the extra burden of trenching and getting electricity out to the site and then putting it in. So it should probably be up, hopefully, for the new year in January.
Okay. So tell us, though, because Wailua School has been around a long time, and so the current billboard that you use or the marquee is falling apart.
It is, yes. The children joke that it was probably there when in 1936 when the school opened. And they have the added burden of having to go out in the hot sun and manually use individual letters to put things up. And it restricts us from sharing a lot of events that are happening. We're very limited to what we can put on there. And, of course, it has to be changed daily or every other day, and so it gets to be laborious.
But it's a little rickety from what I understand.
Yes. It definitely is. Yes, it's an eyesore.
And in a few months, you'll have a brand new one.
Yes, we will. We're really looking forward to it.
So Alika, tell us, because of the timing, what's the plan for the next year, for the next plantation of sunflower seeds?
Well, we'll just have to see what happens with Mother Nature. So that's in agriculture and farming, that's the, number one driver when it comes to how successful and when you can and cannot plant. So we're going to shoot for a June, July timeframe again, but we'll just have to see what happens then.
Okay, but that requires planting when in the year?
If you're going to do that, it's 35 to 40 days from seed to flower. So it would probably be early June, late May planting.
Okay, weather permitting.
Weather permitting. So look at, if you were to plant in the November time frame, you have the end of the hurricane season, but you're getting into the winter season where we have a lot of rainfall. And if you wait till summer, you get the beginning of hurricane season. So we'll just see what happens.
Okay, and then you had mentioned that it was kind of a decision of you can't beat them, join them, invite them in. And you were saying that a lot of the vacation rental companies out there were actually telling their clients, there's this wonderful sunflower farm, go visit.
You'd see advertisements on Facebook or wherever, and you'd have Airbnbs say, hey, come to Wailua with the mysterious sunflower fields and take a tour. There are actually people having tours. They'd meet at a certain site and then take tourist into our field.
Not sanctioned by you.
Yes, not at all.
Okay, so they were sneaking
yes,
in.
Yes.
All right, so you just decided to, hey, we're going to manage this and do it right.
Do it right, do it safely, and see what we can do for the community.
Okay, 20 years and $50,000. It's an awesome 20th anniversary gift to the community.
Yes, thank you very much.
Thank you both.
Thank you.
That was Corteva's Alika Napier and Wailua High School principal Christine Alexander talking about the summer's bright spot as the company celebrated its 20th anniversary on Oahu's North Shore. Earlier this morning for our backyard quiz, we took you to Molokai's Mo'omomi Preserve, located on the island's northwestern coast. The preserve encompasses 921 acres of beach and sand dunes managed by the Nature Conservancy in partnership with the State Department of Land and Natural Resources. The area is home to more than 22 native Hawaiian plant species, and one of them is a Tetramelopium rocki'i, which is believed to be found nowhere else in the world but Mo'omomi. The plant is a member of the sunflower family and thrives in the dry coastal shrublands and dunes found at Mo'omomi. Now, in that environment, the flower is mostly commonly threatened by deer, invasive insects, and plants, and human activity. The common name for this plant is Dune Tetramelopium. Now, that is today's quiz. If you have one, you can send it to talkback@hawaiipublicradio.org. And a shout-out to Thomas from Manoa. You got it right. The Ubon season is drawing to a close. The traditional Buddhist summer festival honors our deceased ancestors. Take a listen to some music from the Awan Festival from the Nu'uanu Nichiren Mission that took place last month. Final Bon Dance for the Summer Festival will be at the Okinawan Cultural Center on Oahu this weekend. Traditionally, it marks the last dance of the season. We talked to Jill Ige, who's been in charge of the Okinawan Festival, about what's in store.
We usually have about five groups who come out to help us with their performances. So we have a lot of our friends and families from all the other Bon Dances show up too.
This is the last one of the season, and it's indoors.
Mm-hmm. It is indoors, which makes it kind of nice to dance in air condition. And even if we had ours over at the festival, it's still kind of nice to have an indoor kind of a feeling.
And so tell us about the festival, because we're just coming off that, and you had a change of locale last year for the first time, because it's traditionally been at Kapi'olani Park, but because of that storm, we had to go to Plan B.
Right. So then 2016, when they had anticipated having, I believe it was Hurricane Lester that was coming through, there was a lot that had to be undone. And the changes had some impact on the organization, but the committee started to look at other venues and other possibilities. And last year was our first year at the Hawaii Convention Center.
Right. There was Hurricane Lane, I think we were dealing with at the time.
Hurricane Lane, yeah.
How did it go?
So I think for our second year, we were able to do a lot of improvements. The first year was, of course, brand new for everyone, so we had no idea what to anticipate. I think our first year, we were just hoping to get at least 30,000 people to come out because of the fact that people were not too sure how it was going to be since we were not in a park. And that, you know, it would have taken away a lot of that atmosphere, but we were really surprised when our numbers came in approximately at about 56,000, and that was over a two-day period, and it was very crowded. Because of those crowds, we were unable to, I think, keep up with the producing of the food, and our line system was not quite defined. So those were two areas we really worked on this year to make the festival a lot better in terms of being able to navigate through it.
And have you got any preliminary numbers back?
No, that takes us about 2 weeks to calculate everything.
So explain to our listeners, because you shared that putting on the festival is really, it's a major undertaking for a lot of your volunteers, many who are getting on with age, and it was just very taxing.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, so when we were at Kapi'olani Park for a good number of years, the backdrop was one of the things at the stage that they would put up. So you would have to have people who were skilled in carpentry to be able to put that up. Then there were the construction of the different booths for the food booths, then helping out with some of the assembly within the tent. You can rent the tent, but it's what you have to set up inside that also took some work as well as time. So given that we had all these different kinds of things to create the festival at the park, the people who were actually doing it were already retired, so they're aging in the last 10 years. We generally didn't have a younger group who were replacing them. And so that was also becoming one of our major manpower issues. As far as just putting on the festival, it does take a great number of volunteers in so many different capacities just to be able to have a festival of this size.
And you got lots of good feedback after that first year when you moved the locale.
Yeah, you know, it's amazing. Air conditioning does wonders for everyone. And so because there was air conditioning, you know, even if people stood in lines, they were not as uncomfortable, and they were also able to see a lot more of the entertainment. So when you don't stand in the hot sun and you're not having the grass scratch your legs and you don't have any flies hanging around or ants crawling into your foot, you realize, like, oh, you know, things can get moved around a lot faster. So we did have, in terms of the facility itself, people were very, very happy with that. You know, the convention center did a really good job of taking care of us as a client. And I think, you know, having clean restrooms, having the accessibility and the floors being smooth and no, how should I say, you know, the uneven ground, that was not issues that they had to deal with. So those are the smaller kinds of things that made the festival a lot better for people last year.
I'm just thinking, if you had a walker or were in a wheelchair, I'm sure getting around the park was a little tricky.
It was. And so it was getting a little difficult for some of our families to bring their older parents or aunties and uncles to come and watch the program. So this way, we've now got a huge area for the stage and many more chairs, which really helps. And again, because you're not dealing with the sun, it was not as bad. You had a lot of comfortable seating to deal with.
Yes, I mean, it's been dreadfully hot this summer.
Oh, yeah. 1 week before, we were just thinking, okay, we could have been at the park trying to set up.
Right.
And wilting.
And wilting, yes, yeah. Precisely. This year, you charged admission to try and get a better handle on the counts.
We did want to try to see, you know, in terms of getting a little more accurate count, at least for the people coming into the first floor. And that was the floor that had our entertainment, food, T-shirts, our country store, plants, and kid games. So those were things that were really popular at families. So we thought, okay, let's try and get our numbers into that way because, again, one way in, one way out in terms of entrances. We had on our third floor access to the various learning rooms and our marketplace. That area did not charge admission. So whether some people even chose not to come downstairs, we're not sure, but we should have a better idea of at least the number that did come in downstairs.
And you did try something different also with the parking this year, right? The Civic Center parking was open with shuttles.
Right, right. So our shuttle extended. So when our convention center area was filled, I think this year it got filled by 10:30. So that's about 850 stalls. They moved over. We always had McKinley High School as our $3 parking with the shuttle. But this year we were able to partner with the city and county, and they helped us out with the Civic Center parking. And then we had a bus pickup there as well.
Okay.
So there were two other places for people who were not able to park at the convention center but still be able to access good parking spaces as well as getting a shuttle ride too.
So at this point, you're going to analyze the data and determine whether maybe the convention center is the venue going forward.
Yes, we still have one more year in our tentative pilot trial period. And so we're going to see what other kinds of things we can do in terms of improvement, different kinds of activities as well. We found out this year our learning rooms were a lot more active. So there were people coming in and participating in the different demonstrations and exhibits, which really helped us.
So more people engaged.
Yeah. I think we're kind of maybe stabilizing at like around maybe 50,000. So we really wanted to thank all the people who did come out because it wasn't just to participate, but all the volunteers. We really, really appreciated their help. That's what helps make our ability to put this festival for the community to learn about the Okinawan culture and heritage.
Okay, and then we'll probably see a lot of the same people at the Bon Dance
The Bone Dance, yes, that is correct. So that one starts at 5:30. And then three of our clubs will be having Andagi. I believe another group might be doing some walking tacos, and there's a couple plate lunch. Just like how when you go to regular Bone Dance, you have the little booths on the side. So it's the same thing. Yes, and of course, all the music that comes with it.
All right. Well, thank you so much. That was Jill Ige, head of the Okinawan Festival, talking about a change in venue for the long-running Okinawan Festival this weekend. She was also talking about the very last Obon dance for the season coming up this weekend. So grab your summer kimonos, the happy coats, and the yukata, and get moving.
Share a little aloha this September. With Foodland's annual matching gift program, your donation is matched by Foodland and the Western Union Foundation. When you're at the register of a Foodland, Sac & Save, or Foodland Farm store anytime this September, remember Hawaii Public Radio and give aloha.
I'm Stephen Dubner. On the next Freakonomics Radio, we recently recorded a live show in Los Angeles. It featured a prominent earthquake expert.
Most people think of California as a place with a lot of earthquakes. The reality is we don't have enough.
And the mayor.
Los Angeles, I like to say it's a place where everybody feels like they belong. A lot of people like diversity and inclusion as words. I think they're less good.
That's next time on Freakonomics Radio.
Tonight at 7, following Counterspin.
That's it for today. Up tomorrow, we open the phone lines to talk to the state consumer advocate. Green energy is fast changing Hawaii's landscape. How do we strike a balance? And what else is on the horizon? Tell us what's on your mind. Share your experience with the wind farm or solar farm in your neighborhood. Call our talk back line. Call 808-792-8217. You can also email us at talkback at hawaiipublicradio.org. We are on Facebook at The Conversation HPR and Twitter at HI Conversation. And if you missed this show or want to find a past one, go to our conversation page. Look under HPR News and Talk on HawaiiPublicRadio.org. I'm Catherine Cruz. Join us tomorrow for more of The Conversation.